Yeah, I'll insert this page.
Oh, that's the upcoming routing.
Yes.
This is one page.
No, okay, fantastic.
We are first on the agenda.
Yes, I thought you wanted to.
I'm already on.
Okay, so let's get started as some of the speakers are in a bit of a rush to get back to their airplane. This is the routing working group at Bright 49. We'll have two sessions this time. The first one is the one that's going to start now for an hour and a half. And the next one it will be tomorrow morning starting at 11. For today's session, the agenda is what you see up there. We'll just start with the typical thing, asking if anyone has anything to add or want anything modified to the agenda before we adapt this as the formal agenda for the working group meeting? No? Okay. I'll get the participants list later. We need a scribe. Is there anyone in the public that wants to volunteer that's not the usual victim from the private CC? No? Okay, well then the victim this time will be Hank. Thank you. The RIPE 48, it should say there. Minutes were circulated to the lists some time ago. I want to apologize because the previous scribe, James Aldrich, did a very good job and delivered the minutes to me almost immediately after the meeting, and then I sat on it for the best part of 2 months. But he eventually posted it, so I wouldn't like to know if there are any comments on them, or shall we just take them as the final minutes? Okay, fine. There weren't any open actions. The two items that we opened last time were solved at the meeting itself, so that was a very quick reaction by the RevNCC to solve things. In that case, let me just...
Dave, how do I switch
the thing? Sorry about that. Okay, just a brief announcement. The RevNCC has me to put this slide up with the list of upcoming routing registry training courses that they provide to the members. Just so you have an idea, the information I'm told is currently not online, but will be shortly at the place that's indicated below. So if you have interest in attending them, just go there and check the details. Having said that, let's go to the real content, and that will be the discussion part of today's EOF presentation by Malcolm Beringer and Christian Panigou. So who of the two wants to do the introduction? Yeah? Prefer this one?
Yeah.
There you go. I'll just get off with me.
Where is it? Okay. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you had a nice lunch and a good break now. It was a long break, and you had some time to think about what we were talking about this morning. Most of you have been there already, so I don't want to really repeat everything, but probably there are some new faces in the room, so I'm going through it, through the second part of this morning's sessions, to just bring us all onto the same level where we then restart the discussion. The goal of this presentation was to introduce some core security techniques and to question them in a way that security always stands against operability and flexibility, and we want to hear your opinion about what level of security might be good or necessary and what level of security would mostly break operability of the current internet. The background was that I was talking to Michael some months ago, and he was presenting some ideas which have come up in the operations community and at some vendors, how to protect the core, and I was very skeptical about it, so It's really not this presentation is not a recommendation how to do things. It's just a listing of things and ideas, and we want to discuss them with you. So one of the things which came up is attacking an IXP or the routers connected to an IXP today seems to be relatively easy because there is one prefix which is well known, and most of the IXP prefixes are announced to the internet, so it might be very easy to just attack 10, 50, 100, even 200 routers at once on an IXP. There was the issue, the idea of transit ACLs, that normally ISP networks permit everything on a core, at least in transit on the core, but under special conditions like emergency because of new worms are spreading or whatever, ISPs started to filter on specific port numbers, for instance, to prevent that their customers are infected or that their infected customers are doing harm to other parts of the internet. This always should, on a core network or on an ISP network, a temporary measure and not something which should grow in a way that on the time scale the internet is getting more and more ports on the internet get blocked. Another discussion point was precedence recoloring at the edge. You have seven precedences in the TCP stack, and 6 and 7, according to an RFC, are, let's say, reserved for routing, which does implicitly probably mean that they should not be used for anything else but routing, but it's not explicitly stated so. So the question is it safe to recolor everything which is coming into your core and has precedence 6 and 7 bit set to a lower precedence? And the specific example was, for instance, eBGP multi-hop configurations where even the payload is really routing information but is traversing your network instead of terminating at your network, are you still allowed to recolor to a lower precedence? So the concept was in the so-called old world that you're securing every router individually, but in principle let the packets arrive at the router, at every individual router, and to take care for security at this specific box only. In the new concept, ISPs are looking for configurations which do not allow packets towards any core routers to come into the core by means of, as we have been discussing, either hiding the core architecturally or putting a kind of a firewall set around the core, which is based on infrastructure ACLs. First, we discussed the core hiding techniques, which might be possible. These are not necessarily the only ways to do it, but to put on three examples. The first one is to use private address space for all your core interfaces. That lets very easily block every packet which is destined to your core network routers at the edge, because RFC 1918 addresses are usually blocked anyway in already existing access lists. But still, you will need some non-private IP addresses, for instance, towards your customers or peers. And one of the big disadvantages, which is common to all the other measures we are following on later, is it makes troubleshooting much harder, or even impossible, from and to core devices. And trace routes through the core should still work, but resolving of the local, of the private addresses is of course not unambiguous, and therefore, either you won't get any information while the packets are traversing your core, which means you are getting stars in the traceroute picture, or you will get RFC 1918 addresses which are not ambiguous. One idea which is not tested and we have not verified if it's really working in that way is using a non-IP control plane, like for instance CLNS and ISIS on top of it, where probably only loopback interfaces get even possibly private IP addresses and the core interfaces are not getting any IP address. We are not sure yet if there is a way to configure that properly, but it might be a way to do that, to hide a core. Of course, it needs support from the platform, so that forwarding is only done on the layer 2 infrastructure, on the layer 2 information, like a switch, so that your routers are turned into a switch infrastructure, basically. Then there was the idea to simply use MPLS. Even if you are not using MPLS as a service towards your customers, it might be useful to use MPLS to hide your core. And that was the model that basically you're putting the internet into a VPN, into VPN 1, and hide everything but the interconnection link between VPN 1 and your core router infrastructure into a different VPN, which is not visible to the outside. Now, that was the part of really hiding your core with techniques like using private addresses, no IP addresses at all, or MPLS technology. And the other technique to secure the core would be, for instance, infrastructure ACLs, like a kind of a firewalling around your core. This means that you have to prepare and design your core network in a way that all the used core addresses are within one aggregatable CIDR block. Otherwise, it would be very hard to construct filtering methods which would scale and which would be manageable. If you are using old 192 addresses, for instance, from different parts of the 192 toxic waste dump space, then you would end up in maintaining access lists with hundreds of entries. If you're putting the customer interfaces also into the core infrastructure address blocks, then this would eventually mean that with infrastructure ACLs, you would also block the access to the customer edge routers. And there is an example which I don't want to go into details now. Well, there's infrastructure ACLs have benefits. It's improving the security against operational mistakes like misconfiguration of individual core routers, and it's helping to prevent vulnerabilities to be deployed by external attackers, and it's generally speaking another layer of security around the core. It does not replace single individual router security. But on the cons side, it breaks transparency, so access from the outside through ping's traceroute into the core does not work. Though traceroute might work through the network, it might probably not deliver all any useful information while traveling through the core. And as a consequence, it makes troubleshooting much harder from the outside. And also from when sitting as a router manager, when connected to a core router and tracing out from the core, it might be impossible to see anything outside the infrastructure ACL protected area. As I said before, it's very hard to deploy if the core address space is not contiguous, because it's very hard to be expressed in a reasonable ACL. And hardware does not necessarily support line speed ACLs, so you have to take care what hardware you are using before thinking about applying infrastructure ACLs on your core interfaces. And it might be hard to maintain when core address space is changing, but if you have a reasonable CIDR block which you are using only for your core interfaces, then it might be not that big of a problem. So what is everybody in this room thinking about protecting the core, and which way could be a way to protect the core, which is the better way to do it, and which way isn't a good one to go? Daniel summarized at the end of the morning session, Daniel summarized his concern with if you're protecting the core, then please use a way that it makes it completely transparent for the end user, meaning that he would prefer to even have a core which is hidden into a VPN or into an MPLS VPN, because then from the end user perspective, the whole core is appearing like one IP layer 3 hop. And you can find, if there is a problem, if I'm saying something wrong, please correct me. Or I didn't see that you're in the room. I was expecting you in the other session. So please,
I just want to make clear that I'm not someone in favor of using MPLS for everything, or for anything for that matter. No, my main statement was, and I think there were lots of people agreeing that if you, for instance, using RFC 1919 address space, which is somehow dear to my heart, in your core, then just make it completely invisible from the outside world, because that address space is not globally unique. And if you introduce the typical way you see it in the outside is by trace routes. So you send these low TTL UDP packets, and you get ICMP time to live exceeded messages back from ambiguous address space, and that shouldn't happen. Because I don't know what it means, right? And any traceroute cannot know what it means. So the whole point I was making is, like, if you're playing those games, then try definitely, if you're using RFC 1918, make it invisible to the outside world, and that this was the specific thing. And the more general thing is, if you're playing games, hiding things inside, then just be consistent about it. So that what you can observe from the outside world is somehow consistent. And my argument actually is, and in the discussion afterwards this came up, my argument is that you're saving yourself lots of work, because if you present a consistent picture to the outside world, you will not get as many queries and about what's happening, and people will generally think you're more professional. That's my whole point. Mm. But the specific point is about 1918 addresses.
Yeah.
And I don't condone MPLS.
So just an off-the-wall idea. If using RFC 1918 addresses has these sort of problems of non-uniqueness, so, but you still need a good chunk of addresses to be able to remember things the way you want them, why don't you use an IPv6 block for that? It's unique. It's even a separate protocol for most of networks today. But it's certainly easy to get a good chunk of it and map it into your network the way you want.
So you assume that IPv6 will always be not used for data traffic?
No, I'm saying that it's easier to get a big chunk that allows you to do whatever you want, so that you can still fit everything into the CIDR block and filter at the edges without having to introduce stupid ambiguity.
want to choose IPv4 space, you can still get it pretty easily. When you say make things trans, when you put words in Daniel's mouth and talk about transparency to the end user, I think what the end user wants is good service. The end user doesn't want to have to run traceroute. The end user of Shane's ISP wants to be able to get packets to the end user of Tim's ISP. And they'll use traceroute when they can't get service from Shane. And the fact is, Shane needs to be able to debug both networks and what goes between them. And having Shane or Tim make their networks some transparent, opaque blob that is consistently not viewed from anywhere is not going to let anybody debug it to make the network work. Okay, so I think it's important to remember that our job, at least those of the operators in the room, is to successfully get packets between them. And part of that success is being able to debug the network. Part of that success is keeping our routers up in a world where there are bad people trying to get them. But we don't sacrifice all of A to get some of B.
Yeah, thank you. So the same discussion, I think, was held, don't know how many years ago, about loose source route and traceroute minus G. And that time there were lots of discussions also like, oh, we can't debug anymore, we don't have traceroute minus G, I have to call an operator to do a traceroute. And although this appeared to be the case at this moment, there was a way found around it with the looking glasses basically to, yeah, find a different point of view where you can do the traceroute from. My point is, so your points are taken, Randy. Question, do you see any benefit in either of these techniques, and do you see the possibility that maybe problems that appear to be problems right now can be solved through other ways?
I do not see any benefit to RFC 19 space. Period. 1918.
Take it abstractly to this idea of making the core not accessible from the outside. Do you see benefit to that?
No. No, you're trying to hide the fact that it's an IP network. This is only going to get you in trouble in some way. It's hard enough to deal with and debug the network. To deal with and debug a fantasy is like running Microsoft GUI interfaces that try to make it easy for brainless people, but unfortunately the same physics is happening underneath, and all they've done is obscure it. And that real physics is still there. If you can make the real physics go away, that's great. But while you're at it, why don't you fix the speed of light problem so we really fix the latency and bandwidth issues?
Just on a sort of a rather relevant note, my colleague who sat next to me is currently applying large pieces of wood to another operator who is using RFC 1918 addresses in their core network, and is making it impossible for us to say, well, there's a problem here, because the customer is going, well, it's sort of, it's your network, look, hop, hop, and then it all disappears. Yeah, it's all the 1918 address being filtered. Not good.
Just for the record, I absolutely agree with Randy. There's no benefit. But if for whatever perceived benefit you, and what I said earlier was not, you know, do this, but if for whatever obscure perceived benefit you do this, then do it right. But obviously usually the people who do it can't do it right, but.
Okay, also just for the record, I want to note that Randy just agreed with everything I said in the morning session, which must be a first.
And I will also want to reiterate the fact that not all ICMP is useless. It really does useful stuff, such as path MTU discovery. And please remember this. And don't think all my network is 1,500 bytes. There are often tunnels. There are often PPP interfaces. There's all kinds of stuff that is smaller than 1,500 bytes, and you really need those ICMP packet to big packets to get out there. And while you're at it, you might as well let those port unreachables through so people don't have to wait for 3 minutes for their timeouts.
So a bit of a different opinion. I think there are several proposals here, and I think they need to be addressed independently. I mean, you can prevent people from addressing your core routers without breaking traceroute and without breaking all the agnostic tools. And you can do it with using global routable addresses. So maybe the traceroute issue and RFC 1918 is a bit orthogonal to some of the things that Michael is proposing. So let's not put it everything in the same bucket and analyze the pros and cons distinctively.
Yeah, thanks, Pedro. And I think that's a good statement, because I would like to have this discussion more on an abstract level. Like, is there any point in actually not letting packets into the core? And so we have one, Randy's comment says, absolutely no, there is no value, every packet must get everywhere. And I have a different one.
So what I'm trying to say is there's different ways of achieving that, and whether you do one or the other, that's a detail.
I mean, it's a bit like what reality you're faced with. If you have daily DDoS attacks targeted at your loop banks, and you cannot find another way to filter them on a box per se, you have to go out to the network and try to find other mechanisms to do this. At some point, it's not so much of a choice, because there's only so much you can do on an individual host, and gets back to the entire discussion in security of centralized versus distributed control. The problem with securing every single, loopback is that you have 1,000 devices, all of them with individual characteristics. If you try to do it on a host by host basis, I mean, it goes back, if you look into the enterprise space, yes, firewalls present a connectivity problem. But it's not realistic today to go to tell an enterprise, get rid of your firewall. I think in one way we're going to kind of go into the same direction here, where you need to be able to specify a central policy to access your internal network, and it's going to occur slowly over time. And it's not necessarily a good thing, but
I just want to restate my point from this morning, that hiding the core and making the core inaccessible for packets coming from the outside aren't the same thing. There's the thing where you protect it against packets coming in, and there's the thing where you make it invisible so no packets that are generated in there come out and tell the world about stuff that happens there, such as TTLs reaching zero and stuff like that. And also I want you to think about, if you do hide the core, this basically means that debugging IP networks will be the same as debugging Ethernet networks is now. And anyone who has ever tried to debug a hop Ethernet network that didn't work will know that this is no fun.
Okay, I'm somehow happy that my skeptical face towards Michael was now supported by the audience. I think it was really, really useful to hear all the opinions about that. Is there anybody? I was asking this already in the morning, but probably there are new people in here. Is anybody using kind of core hiding or infrastructure ACLs at the core to protect the own core at the moment?
Yeah, we're using something a bit like infrastructure ACLs where you can't send packets to most of our core.
What are you filtering out?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we've got to deny...
Also ICMP, for instance?
You can't send any packets to the core routers themselves. The core routers can send ICMP to the rest of the world. But along with denying RFC 1918 addresses and our own IP space coming from the internet, we also drop things destined to the core routers. So far, we haven't had any problems with that.
Mm-hmm.
But...
Just your neighbors trying to debug why your network isn't getting their packets there, having the problems. You don't see any problems at all. To go back to Pedro, DDoS is a problem of distributed source. It's also a problem of distributed destination. They're DOSing my routers. They're DOSing my servers. They're DOSing CPE, etc. While we will try to harden each one of those, we won't do so to such an extent that it makes our network hard to manage. I think the DDoS problem needs to be solved nearer the edge and the source of the DDoS. It's both, of course, but once again, I want to remind people of the work by J.I., Sally Floyd, Steve Belevin et al. On pushback, and that's the only dynamic solution that's been proposed to actually push back on DDoS.
So, David Reeder, Zen Internet. Just as an example of the sort of thing we're talking about here, any of you have got your laptop in front of you, if you can attempt a trace route to 213. Point. Sorry. Start again. Yeah, okay.
Right.
Sorry. Is this one on?
No. It is.
Okay. If you can ignore everything else on there, obviously the trace route in the middle of the screen there to that destination. We are currently seeing this problem with one UK network. From some networks, we see what you see there. We trace through their network and receive a response from an RFC 1918 address as the endpoint. Other networks can reach the endpoint correctly. And I'm currently in a long, drawn-out fight with this particular provider over this, who can't see that there's any problem with this, and I've got a customer screaming at me because they cannot get to that endpoint. And we presently have a stalemate on this. And RFC 1918 in the core is just a complete minefield of, it's a waste of time.
But to reiterate the point I was trying to make a few moments ago, is that the people with that core don't see the problem. They just cause the problem to the rest of the world.
Exactly, yes.
Right? So the benefit is not where the cost is. And any time we have that, we have a broken culture.
So... first of all, I fully agree with you. This is ugly. This should not be there. So let's get this straight. But one other point now. So assume you are getting proper IP addresses back. What's next? What's next is you will see the trace route. You will see where the trace route stops. And then you have to tell the guys as well, look, debug your network. The only thing is that you know what's happening. What's actually the difference in terms of actions?
But you may get a hope of them actually fixing it when you can say, see, it's broken right there.
Okay, point taken. So So I agree with that, and that. So don't get me wrong, this is ugly, right? But still, I think, Randy, your point that there's absolutely no value in not getting packets into the core, I think, is also slightly on the extreme side. I think there is a value.
Me, extreme? What?
Oops, did I say that out loud?
So, I also think there's a very significant difference between not returning a valid trace route and not allowing you to explicitly ping one of the core routers. You know, basically the comment that was made by that gentleman that they do not allow you to send packets to their network, it doesn't mean that they do not return valid trace routes. Their trace routes can still be valid, it's just you cannot send packets to their core routers.
And it's also, Pedro, as you were saying, the DOSing of a loopback. You can trace route. At no point have I seen where access to the loopback interfaces are useful in debugging a problem with a peer's network. And therefore, preventing access to the loopbacks is not going to cause me a problem. It's the interfaces through which packets go that I care about on a trace route and following, yeah?
I'm sorry, I've been a bit victim of my employer's mindset. When I mean packets to the loopback, I mean packets to any of the local addresses on the host. And again, it depends. The assumption here is packets to internal addresses, so non-EBGP peering session addresses can be dropped, and I think that's reasonable common practice at the moment.
Can I just add that I don't see the value in sending packets to my router interface themselves, because that's not the same path that the packet to the destination address takes. You may be following a completely different route and a completely different routing protocol to get there. So there's no real value in following that, sending the packet to that interface.
Okay. Thank you. I think we got many inputs, and Michael, do you want to summarize?
Not really. Good thing that Randy was here. You weren't in the morning session. I think that would have spiced up discussion a bit too. I think there are different ways of seeing the thing. Actually, taking it a step back, if you go to the pros and cons slide that we had, would you actually agree with those? So what I would really like to do is to have a set of pros and cons, give that to people, and everybody can decide for themselves. Because we were trying to make objective points. So if we have failed in that, we should know about it. That's the cons, and the pros is that one. Okay, shall I take silence as agreement?
Yes.
And let's call it a day, shall we?
Yeah, I think the major point here is that there are severe concerns against really hiding the core, but there are not so severe concerns against properly implementing infrastructure ACLs. That would be my summary of this. And that would also fit with my idea of running the internet or continue to run the internet. Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, well, thank you for the lively discussion. Since this took actually slightly less time than it was allocated, and I had a request from RIPNCC to present a very short presentation on RIR offset,
I'm going to go ahead and insert that right now before Tim Griffin's presentation, if he doesn't mind. Oh, it's good because he's not here, actually. Oh, there. So it's like 5 minutes or so.
Yeah. Hopefully this won't take too long, and this won't be as interesting as the discussion we just had. This is just kind of a follow-up on some of the discussions that happened at the last Write meeting about the IRR toolset. So I'll just jump in. Outlined here, well, pretty much all my presentations look the same, background discussion and some summary. So background. Long ago, there was a software package called the RA toolset. And this is a set of programs designed to work with internet routing registries. I guess most people here at least know what an internet routing registry is, but it's a place where you record your policy information in a public database. The original RA toolset was written by ISI, and it was part of the Routing Arbiter project, which is why it's the RA toolset. And I believe this was something funded by the U.S. government as trying to do some work on helping scale the internet, kind of in the first half of the 1990s, I believe. Basically, when the project ended, it became kind of a cost for ISI to maintain it. They weren't really interested in it, and so to avoid the software being abandoned, the Ripe NCC agreed to take it over. When we did this, we renamed it the IRR toolset to make it more properly reflect the actual purpose of the software. So I'm going to go in a different direction here and kind of explain the Ripe NCC open source model, which isn't something that we've ever actually written down or discussed. It's kind of a de facto model that we have. And the way it works is that we write some code at the Ripe NCC, and we do this when we can't find anything else to do what we need done. So we have a number of fairly specialized things that we do, because we hand out IP addresses and we run the Whois server and things like that. So we write software to meet our needs operationally. Because we actually use the software we write, we're pretty much guaranteed a certain level of quality because we need it to run our business. We also publish this source code on occasion. We don't publish everything we write, but we try to make it available for other people where we can. And our motivation here is that we want it to be useful for other people. Now, we do release this, and our release cycle is based on this model. And basically, changes happen often. Every time we find a bug, we go in and we fix it. When we need a new feature, when the community asks us for something, we add it, and we put it into production pretty much right away. We run basically what you'd consider bleeding-edge code. What we don't do is then publish this very often, because to actually put together a release takes a significant amount of resources from us engineering-wise. We have to put together release notes, test it on the target platforms, et cetera, these kind of things. Now, as I said, at Write 48, there were a number of concerns about the IRR toolset, and I listed those here. One was that we weren't tracking latest RPSL NG drafts, and this is a draft which is actually in the RFC editor queue right now. But the idea is you take RPSL and you add IPv6 multicast information to it. And there were some changes in the drafts that we hadn't implemented in the IRR toolset. And there was actually a secondary concern, which is that the IRR toolset didn't work with the right prototype server for the server side. There were a number of bugs that were reported and patches that were submitted which hadn't been included into the release software. And a big complaint was that it didn't compile with GCC3, which has been kind of the standard compiler for a number of years. So I think based on the slides describing our software model, what we did is we thought about it, and we decided that really the way that we write software doesn't really match what the community needs for the IRR toolset. So what we decided to do was try to find someone who had a better match between what they did and what the IRR toolset needed. So we decided to find a better home for it. And ISE agreed to take this product on and support it. And I think they're a really good choice for this. They support a number of open source programs. I think we're all familiar with Bind and DHCP, and they support a new server and things like that. All these softwares are network-oriented, although they are quite different. and they're well equipped to handle patches submitted by users and track bugs and things like that, which our model doesn't really allow us to do that very easily. So current status, since RIPE 48, we've implemented the latest version of the RPSL and GDraft. We've integrated all the patches that we've received. We've fixed all the known bugs. And one of the patches that was submitted to us actually included GCC3 integration. I didn't put the name of the nice person who submitted that. But so as far as we're concerned, all the issues that were brought up at RIPE 48 have been addressed with this software package. So we're not just handing it over to ISC non-working state. We've been working with ISC, moving over the original code repositories that we received from ISI, as well as all the changes we've made since then. We've tarred up all the mailing lists and web pages and some personal emails and things like that. And as soon as we get everything up and running and get the changes changes up on ISC's web page, we'll go ahead and send out kind of a joint announcement to let everyone know that this activity is going on. Final thing, in the future, we're not just going to drop support for this. We're going to help ISC if they have any questions about the code and things like that. And we will continue to support the right protocol so that if we make changes on the server side, that we'll make sure that the IR toolset will continue to support it. And, anything else the community wants us to do in this software, we'll go ahead and put together patches and submit them. And that is it.
Randy? ISC have any comment on the licensing model they're going to use? GPL?
We were not going to change it. The license it has now is the BSD type license, right, that it has from the university, and that's what we were planning to.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? No. Just be aware of sticky things that move behind you when you move companies. Tim.
So let's all pretend we're in Fiji. So we have at least a fun reason to explain this insufferable heat.
Bula.
Bula, yes. Obviously I just gave this talk a few weeks ago in Fiji, and since then, Jeff Houston and I put together a draft that was submitted to the GROW working group on this topic. So if you have any comments on this, I'd really appreciate that you send some email to us. Thanks. So what I want to talk about is, this is really a consciousness-raising talk. It's about a certain kind of anomaly that we can get in BGP routing, and we don't have a lot of solutions. It's just really an awareness issue, and it's related a lot to community craziness. There's a lot of interdomain signaling going on the internet using communities, and which is extremely useful and helpful, but there is a downside, and that's what this talk is really about. So the problem is, let's see if I can get this right. This one? Okay. So, what is a BGP wedgie? So, first of all, the thing that I'm calling a three-quarter wedgie here might be, I've heard people call this, these are actually, this is a PDF version that seems to not have been translated very well from the PowerPoint, so sorry, some things look a little bit weird here. Anyway, so maybe what has been called route pinning in the past What I mean by this is that locally you look at the BGP policies, they make sense. Right? So I'm not talking about misconfiguration. And I'm talking about situations where the BGP policies actually allow multiple intra-domain solutions or routings. That is, once one is installed, it's stable. Okay? And that some are intended and some are not intended. Okay? So I'm going to give examples of this. So this might be called route pinning. And then what makes a three-quarter wedgie a full wedgie is this extra thing that can happen, is that the actual policy interactions that cause this can span multiple ASs in a way that no one set of operators can figure out what the heck is going on. Okay? And that's not a good thing. Okay? So hopefully an example will help clarify this. So this is an example using backup communities or deprefme communities. Here we have a customer AS1 with backup and primary links, and they're going to implement that backup link with a deprefme community sent up to the provider AS2. Okay? So this is just some community that AS2 configuration interprets as give that customer a lower preference than normal. Okay, very commonly used on the internet, but there's a problem here in that there are actually two stable routings. Okay, so let me explain. The one on the left is the one that's probably intended by everyone involved. Okay, that is, the backup link is not being used. What I mean by the heavy arrows here are those are the actual routes that are being used for forwarding. So AS2 forwards to its provider, over to a peer, and down to the customer, and that's exactly what the customer wants. Okay? But this other routing is actually stable too. If you install this routing in BGP, it will stay there. And is as stable as the other routing. And why is that? Well, let's look at it. AS3 says, hey, I've got two routes, one from a customer and one from a peer. I prefer customers. Always over peers. AS2, did I say AS3 or AS2? Okay, that's what I meant. AS3 likes that customer route. AS2 has not translated the deprefme community that it's receiving from its customer to a deprefme community for its upstream provider. Therefore, you know, AS3 has no reason to dislike this route. And from AS2's point of view, it's the only route it knows. Sure, it deprefed the thing, right? It has the route from AS1, it deprefed it, but hey, it's the only one it knows. So once you install this routing, it's solid. Okay? And so what's going to happen is AS1 is probably going to call up AS2 and say, hey, your web page says if I attach this community, you're going to depref me, right? And so why aren't you doing the right thing? You were doing the right thing last week, and they're going to scratch their heads and look at it, and perhaps what they're going to do is reset the session. That's something you can do. Reset the BGP session and bounce the thing, kick the thing back over to the other solution. And I think most operators would say, Cisco bug, right? Has to be a Cisco bug. But it's not. It's just the interaction of these policies, global interaction of what seem like locally sane policies. Okay? Any questions? Any doubts about this? How many people have seen this sort of thing? I would be interested to hear stories. Maybe we'll have time if I speed through this real quick. Okay? So the real point here is we've got to kick the thing back into shape, you know, it's not going to happen automatically, which is not a good thing for an automated routing protocol. Now imagine this. You're in this situation. AS1 now has a customer, two providers, and it does exactly, you know, it has two prefixes, P1, P2, and what it does is it does load balancing, and we've all seen this. You know, maybe P1 is a supernet of P2, whatever. It treats It treats one link as a primary for one prefix and the other link as a primary for the other prefix. Okay? And now look what happens. If we get wedged, well, unwedging, if you're rather crude and just reset the session, so unwedging one prefix will kick you into a wedge for the other prefix. Right? So you're really stuck here, and I don't know many operators who could figure this one out. I mean, imagine your upstream on the left is in, you know, it's in New York, and on the right it's in Paris, and those two groups of operators don't even talk to each other very often. I'd like to see them figure this one out. And if they call up and complain to their upstream providers here, I doubt they will be able to figure it out. But I'm still willing to call this a three-quarter wedgie. So for the full wedgie, here's an example. If this is a slight modification of the first one, I've just added that provider AS5 there, and it's a peer of AS2s. And now AS1 has two backup links for a particular prefix. Okay? And it implements the one for AS2, like I said before. AS2 prefers that route less than the route from its upstream provider AS3. But AS5 has just implemented that differently. It's going to implement the depref me as, yeah, you know, I'll take the preference of this thing below my upstream provider, but not below a peer. Okay? So there you go. And now the routings are the intended routing on the left. Is that right? Actually, I think that arrow from AS5, yeah, that's right. That's right. I'm sorry. I get confused every time I look at this. Anyway, so that's right. Intended routing on the left and a unintended routing on the right. Again, this is the same situation as before. AS1 says, hey, calls up AS2, complains, or maybe they've had this problem before, so they say, hey, reset the session. Right? But the problem is here, look, if I reset that session, take that session down, I'll bounce back and forth between these two routings. And now, you know, AS5 is sending traffic down where it wasn't before. Right? So what's up here? The only thing I think you can do here is you can have, so suppose you're in this situation here. Right? You can reset both sessions, okay, and kick the system back to where it was and then bring them up, back up. But the problem there is try convincing the folks in AS5 that they have to reset a BGP session that they're not even carrying traffic on, right? They're not even using that route they're learning from AS1 directly as their best route. It's their alternate route. And you're telling them, reset the session on that session so we can kick the system back. I'll bet this would take a long time to fix in an operational setting. It's hard enough to understand just in this very simplified situation, but I think in an operational setting it would be something of a nightmare to try to debug this problem. By the way, we've all heard of med oscillation problems. These problems are actually very closely associated with med oscillation, in the sense that BGP is really not a designed protocol. When you think about the policy languages, how you can configure routing policies, it has just evolved, right? There's really no good theoretical underpinning for the design of those policy languages. So you can write policies that interact in a way where you get 0, 1, 2, 3, 100 different possible routings. And when you get 0, what happens? Protocol oscillation. Right? BGP exchanges messages until you converge on a solution. And if there is none, well, you get oscillation. So these problems are actually related to the lack of sort of an underlying guarantee, let's say, in the policies we write in BGP that they're sensible in some sense. Okay? So, I said this in words. What we can do is bring down those two sessions. At least maybe what we could do is filter out the two prefixes involved. We don't actually have to bring the sessions down, but at least filter out the prefixes involved and then bring them back up. And we kicked it back. Okay? So I'll just skip over these. The point of these next slides is just, you know, things can arise in all sorts of ways, including, let's say, traffic engineering between sibling ASs. Let's say an ISP has an AS in various ASs in different continents, and you're doing traffic engineering between those ASs. Same kind of thing can arise. Okay? So really, again, this talk is really just an awareness talk, and I think maybe the use of very expressive interdomain communities, we should think about that and think about how we might want to standardize the semantics of some of those. For example, if we standardize deprefme communities so that people implemented them consistently and translated them to the, you know, into communities for their neighbors, then we might have a better situation. But then again, not all ASs are going to be willing to implement communities or to accept communities from their neighbors. So it's a problem. Also, perhaps we can use some tools for analysis of configurations, but this is a little bit, pie in the sky, perhaps. So I'll wrap it up there. Do we have time for a few comments about some folks raised their hands when I asked if they had encountered these things in practice. Would anybody be willing to talk about it, or not now? I know it's kind of embarrassing to talk about your wedgies in public. Jeff is coming up.
Jeff Houston, APNIC. Tim, in that last sentence or so, you kind of intimated that this would be easier if deprefme was a transitive attribute. And it certainly would correct some of this case. But I was just wondering, is it actually sensible that a deprefme community should be transitive or not?
Well, I'm just saying that if we want this kind of stuff to work, I don't see any other choice, right, but to have some sort of consistent global semantics for these communities that's consistently implemented. I know it's not a nice thought, but I don't see any other way.
So on the examples that you cited, there's actually one way to fix that. And again, it doesn't work on all the examples. And the one way to fix that is to get your eBGP sessions to advertise not only the best route that you have, but to advertise the best route that you have that doesn't come from the peer I'm talking to. Which, this kind of support was part of RFC 1771 and was kind of abandoned for a very long time. And if anybody is willing to play with these kind of things in their boxes, they can chat with me sometime.
So in other words, you're saying don't implement what might be called poison reverse, right? Where you don't tell your neighbors about, you don't, if you send me a route to P, I don't tell you my best route to P, right? Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying you send me your best route,
yeah,
and I select it.
Yeah.
But then I can advertise you my second best route.
Oh, I see.
So then you get out of a situation where you sort of, because if you go back on your example, and again, this doesn't work for all sorts of scenarios because you can always build another ES in a graph.
Yeah, but I mean, the thing is, that makes it a little bit easier to debug certain situations. But it's not going to take care of the general case, I think. Yeah. It's a hack, yeah.
Could you go back to the slide that shows the diagrams?
Well, there are a lot of diagrams. Which one?
Keep going. The three side by side. You talked about some of the tools, and I think you were talking about ones that evaluate policy in advance. I'm wondering, what sort of tools do you have today that allow, say, the AS1 to determine which of those configurations you currently have, and what sort of tools would you imagine would help a debugger figure out what's going on there that you'd like to have?
Yeah, the thing is, I'm not really thinking about, socialism in one AS. You would have to actually get ASs, at least in some group, to cooperate and analyze their configurations together, because just any single AS is not going to have enough information in it for you to debug the problem. So, it goes back to this old problem, right, of RPSL. People wanted to use it so they could put policies in a database and then check consistency, right? Well, how do you get people to do that? Then it turns out that consistency checking is an intractable problem. And, so I don't really have a good answer to that. But I think that at least on smallish networks, so if I had, network ASs in multiple continents and I configured all of those, well, then I could at least analyze my own network for these problems. So again, just a consciousness raising, I think you should put BGP wedgies in the category with med oscillation as something to look for.
Yeah. I don't want to basically say you should use one bad technique to fix another problem, but actually you could, for most of these things, if you aggressively prepended, avoid the...
Actually, that's not true, because the problem with prepending, of course, is that folks prefer their customers no matter how long the AS path is. So you can't actually get the intended routing here with prepending. Because, AS2 here is going to prefer customers no matter what.
It depends on how you make your policies.
Yeah, I'm just saying, standard implementation.
Yeah, Daniel, the bad thing that is, for debugging things with prepending, the nice thing is that you are seeing what signaling is going on. But the policy that Tim is mentioning is still invisible.
And if an AS is not preferring their customers by default, I think I know how to put them out of business. Right?
Thank you. And our next and last talk for today is by Zhang Xu on inter-domain routing instabilities.
Good afternoon. My name is Zhang Shu, and I'm from the National Institute of Information and Communications Technology in Japan. Very glad to have this opportunity to talk here. The title of this talk is Measurements on the Inter-Domain Routing Instability. Firstly, I'm going to explain why we have focused on the intra-domain routing in our research. Then I'll show you some results of two experiments that we did on two academic networks in Japan, the Wide Internet and the APAN-GP network. After that, I'll introduce RT Analy, which is a system we developed to detect and visualize intra-domain routing changes. And finally, some summaries. In this talk, inter-domain routing instability is referred to as the unexpected routing changes within an IGP routing domain. By unexpected routing changes, we mean the changes caused by some unknown reasons, but not due to normal network maintenance. As you know, when routing instability occurs, the network needs to reconverge, and it can lead to packet loss, increase the router load, and wasted bandwidth. So we need to do something if it is a problem. But why have we focused on the intra-domain routing? This is because from the aspect of reachability, although we think the intra-domain routing is just as important as inter-domain routing is, so far the research on IGP behaviors is still poor. So we hope by this presentation we can help network operators better understand the inter-domain routing instability. The methodology of our measurement is quite simple. Firstly, we collected routing messages. Because in Japan, most network providers use OSPF for intra-domain routing. In our measurement, we used OSPF messages. OSPF is a link state routing protocol. So by connecting a data collector to an Ethernet segment, which is configured as a part of the OSPF backbone area, we can passively record all the OSPF routing messages. The tool we used was TCP dump. Then we analyzed the data by counting routing changes. By routing changes, we mean changes in the content of an OSPF RSA. For example, the changes in the attached links, routers, or link metrics. We also counted RSA flush as a routing change. However, we didn't count changes in the AS external RSAs because they do not reflect any intra-domain routing change, intra-domain topology change. Our first measurement was conducted on the wide internet. The wide internet is a national academic network in Japan, and it is operated as a part of the wide project. It connects hundreds of academic organizations, and in total, there are about 50 routers in the OSPF backbone area. The target of our second measurement was the APMGP network, which is a part of the Asia-Pacific Advanced Network. This network connects many foreign countries in the Asia-Pacific region, and its main function is to provide transit services among academic organizations in these countries. Because of this, the scale of this network is relatively small, but this provides with us a good example to see what can happen on such small-scale networks. Here are some results from the wide internet. This graph shows us the number of daily router RSAs and the number of changes observed in all these router RSAs. Because the router RSA includes the basic link state status for each router, by this graph we can have a general view on the routing changes occurring on the wide internet. The data is from August 2000 up to this May. The red line is the number of router RSAs, and the blue line is the number of changes. You can see that almost in all of the days, some changes have occurred. And in most days, the number of changes has been relatively low. However, the number can be quite high from time to time, and sometimes it can reach 11,000 a day. Here I need to point out that some of these changes were caused by network maintenance, but still the number is much higher than we had expected. These are the results for the other three intra-domain RSAs, which are network RSA, network summary RSA, and ASBR summary RSA. As for the router RSA, in most in both the days, the number of changes is was relatively low. However, it can be quite high at times. And for the summary RSAs, you can see that sometimes a lot of routing changes can occur in the other areas of the wide internet. This is the result for the APN network. Again, the number of router RSAs and the number and their changes are shown here. You can see that the overall trend is like that of the wide internet. That is, in most days, the number was relatively low. However, it can spike upward from time to time. Here in this graph, the first and the third spikes were caused by a problem of an ATM link. The second one is caused by the misconfiguration of router ID. And the last one is caused by an Ethernet switch problem. From here, I will show you some RSA oscillation patterns and their possible causes. We divided all the observed routing changes into four categories. They are relatively frequent and frequent oscillation in short term, relatively frequent and less frequent oscillation in long term. This is an example of the most typical routing oscillation, which occurred relatively frequently in short term. You can see that one day in early May, this router RSA changed twice in the early morning, declaring the down and up of two attached links. It began the up-down advertisement again from noon, and this time it continued oscillating for about 4 hours. In our measurements of all observed routing patterns, routing changes, changes like this were observed most often. And we found that most of this kind of changes were caused by network congestion, but they can also be caused by layer 2 problems. Here we have an example of a very serious oscillation. This graph shows us the number of RSA changes for a layer 3 switch in 24 hours last year. You can see that it changed relatively. It changed quite frequently at a rate about 70 times every 5 minutes. And in total, it changed more than 16,000 times in 18 hours. In our measurements, we observed this kind of oscillation for several times, and most of them were caused by the misconfiguration of using the same router ID on two different routers. And in this case, you will see only one RSA changing. This kind of oscillation can also be caused by P2P link or interface problems. And in that case, you will see two RSAs is flapping. These are the other examples of relatively frequent and less frequent oscillation in long term. The upper graph is a one-day result for a router located in San Francisco. You can see that it changed relatively frequently, and this oscillation lasted for more than 5 months. The lower one is for a router located in Kyoto. Compared with the upper one, it changed relatively slow, only several times a day. However, this oscillation had persisted for more than 2 months. In our measurements, most of this kind of long-term changes were caused by interface or link problems. We identified some causes for the observed routing instability. There are network congestion, some of which were caused by the DDoS attacks. Also, link or interface failure. operators misconfiguration or software and software bugs. Now I'd like to introduce a system named RT Analy, which we developed to detect and visualize IGP changes. It has following features. First of all, it can detect IGP changes in real time and alert operators of the changes by email. And it can also be used for offline data analysis. The second feature of this system is a visualization of the routing changes. By this, we can make it easier for operators to figure out at what time and to what extent the routing changes is occurring on the network. The results of the system are accessible through the web interface. So you can see it wherever you have a web browser. The system supports OSPF V2, V3, and ISIS, which are the three most widely deployed intra-domain routing protocol. And currently, you can run this system on the BSD variants or some Linux boxes. Let's look at an example. This page is a top page for the APAN network, and today's status is shown there, and you can see so far no intra-domain RSA changes has occurred. This graph, the lower graph is a statistical results for the routing changes in the past. By this graph, we can have a general view on the routing changes which occurred in the past. And you can also specify the term for which you want to see the statistical results. And you can also see the results in further detailed analysis by clicking a number of the RSA changes. Let's pick a date. In this page, the statistical results for each RSA type will be shown. And also there is a ranking list in which the router RSA the RSA will be sorted by the number of changes. For example, in this case, the router RSA for the router of TPPR is ranked first with a number of 17. And if you click on the number of changes, you will get some further detailed analysis on this RSA. The daily graph, monthly graph, and the yearly graph of this router RSA will be shown here, and you can also see how the content of this RSA has changed. For example, by this line, you can see an interface to a stub network had gone. Please refer to this URL for more examples. Currently, most work of this system has been done, and currently and we are doing some final preparation toward official release, which we hope we can do in early next month. Now to summarize, today I had talked about some measurements that we did on intra-domain routing instability. We found that regardless of network scale, intra-domain routing instability can occur frequently and persistently. So we think it's important for you, for network operators, to to deploy a monitoring system on your own networks. And I also introduced RT Analy, which is a system we developed to detect and visualize intra-domain routing changes in real time. Here I'd like to thank WISE Project and the Naira Institute of Science and Technology, as well as operators of the APNGP network for their help during the data collection. Also, thank you for your attention.
Thank you for the presentation. Are there any questions regarding this? Or actually, I should just ask. When you say release, that this will be probably released in October, you mean that everyone is going to be able to download it and install it locally?
Yes.
Okay. Just, so, does anyone have any comments and questions on this talk? Tim?
Just curious how you grab the SLAs to establish an OSPF session with the...
We use TCP dump to passively record all the OSPF routing messages.
Okay.
Non-intrusive then. Okay, well, thank you very much for coming on this long way for your presentation. So this was the last presentation for today's session. I think all of the presentations you saw here today are already available on the website, on RIPE's website. So if you have, you want to look up any of the URLs that were mentioned and stuff, you can just download them and have a look at them. That's it for today then. We'll be back with the routing review tomorrow, I think after the coffee break, which is starting at 11. And see you there.